previously on Popping Collars.
I mean, there are a few bands that are like that. I mean, I would say that, you know, certainly Springsteen is like that. Certainly the old arena bands that Ricardo pointed out were like that at some point.
I lost a lot of cred.
I think it...
Just saying one word sticks. Lost all my cred.
Stop.
I'm going to sing sticks throughout the show. Just so you know.
Just drop lyrics here and there. It's going to be great.
That's right. Those will be, all my answers will be in sticks lyrics.
Excellent.
Welcome to Popping Collars, guys. The podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. The show where priests, pastors, ministers, and religious thinkers from around the country weigh in on what people are binge-watching, tweeting about, trolling on message boards, and celebrating on blogs. My name is Greg Knight. I am coming to you from Palm Beach, Florida, and I am your host of this roundtable conversation with our guests, who this week include two noobs, as it were.
Yeah.
From Berkeley, California, it's Andy Schammel. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Greg.
And from Chandler, Arizona, we have Dominic Moore. Hello.
Hi.
Dominic.
Good to be here, Greg.
And the level 50 black mage of Popping Collars from Emporia, Kansas, the Chris Arnold. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Greg. Hello, Popping Collars faithful.
This is episode 13 of Popping Collars, and our topic today is video games. The world of gaming has come a long way in most of our lifetimes. We've moved from Pong to Pac-Man, from Breakout to Bioshock, from Mario to Mass Effect. And with every advance in graphics and story complexity and control mechanics comes new ways of engaging virtual worlds that could only be dreamed of in the days of ColecoVision, right? So with the increased nuance of games comes increased scrutiny, however. Gamers have been slapped with labels from being geeks that live in their parents' basements to being more prone to violence against others, lazy accusations that aren't supported by research. But you can see how these myths come about, right? Gaming consoles keep putting out first-person shooter after first-person shooter, one really indistinguishable from the next. Mobile gaming caters to addictive personalities with in-app purchases that just escalate and escalate. MMORPGs require massive time commitments in order to remain competitive, usually just monotonously grinding experience points. And so I wonder, like, which games appeal to you? And what do your favorite games do for you? In other words, so, like, how do the games that you play feed you, if at all? Andy, you want to kick us off?
Wow, yeah, sure. Let's see, what am I playing right now? Right now, I'm playing Icewind Dale Enhanced Edition. The company is bought all the classic Black Isle, BioWare, D&D properties and has revamped them for new platforms. Yeah, the thing I... So I'm a big RPG RPG player, and as Greg can attest, I played long hours of World of Warcraft in class, actually.
We sat in the back row. I can...
Spoilers, seminary professors definitely played WoW in class. Speaking of grinding for experience points.
But I'm so disappointed. So disappointed in you all.
The other one I was playing a lot of before I kind of OD'd was Crusader Kings 2. And so I love these games that are immersive, that are kind of sandbox. You can sort of do almost whatever you want within a pretty robust environment. And I just really enjoy that. I enjoy that experience of, even if it's in a very schematic kind of abstract way, I really enjoy that experience of being in a different way. So
it's this idea of freedom, creativity.
It's freedom and creativity and in some kind of alternative setting where, you know, I have a different set of options available to me than I do in my real life.
Cast magic missile.
I cast magic missile at the darkness. I mean, that's right. As one does.
Right. Yeah, that's not something that I've encountered in my ministry, being able to cast magic missile.
I'm working on it. If I figure it out, I'll let you know.
Chris, what are you playing?
I just made a list and looking it over, and there's a remarkable consistency. They're all AAA, you know, so pretty big budget, well produced games, all with that sort of immersive sandbox feel to them. I've got on the list here in the last couple of years: Fallout, Borderlands, Fable, Grand Theft Auto, Saints Row, Assassin's Creed, and I just finished 2 days ago. I finished playing through Watch Dogs. So, and then when I'm not kind of immersing myself in the open box kind of action RPG world, I'm nearly always coming back to some sort of hockey game because I'm a big hockey fan and I like pretending that I'm, you know, on the Bruins because I never will be in real life. Very sad.
Don't give up on your dreams, Chris.
No, I know. 40 years old, I still have, you know, I still have hope.
Dom, what are you playing?
Well, like Andy, I really love RPGs. I've always been a complete sucker for RPGs. And so right now I'm playing two, actually. I'm working my way very slowly because it's a huge game through Dragon Age Inquisition. And I'm playing some Dark Souls 2 also, which I'm sticking my toe into that wonderful world of suffering. And actually, Dark Souls 2 is very Lenten. We could talk about that. I'm also a huge fan of grand strategy games as well, and so I recently was very late to the party in picking up another Paradox game, Andy, not Crusader Kings, but Europa Universalis 4, which is fan-flippin-tastic. I mean, I have not, like, just obsessed over a game like this in ages. It is so good. And again, it's something about the historical setting. It's a game that I feel like I learned from. You know, I feel like I understand politics better. I understand what 1700s European politics would have been like. And, you know, it does something about the way that game models diplomacy and trade is so, so good. It's incredibly rich. And you can have a totally different experience whether you're playing, a little European Brandenburg or something like that, or Naples, or whether you can play as like a Japanese daimyo and you can, you know, take over Japan, or playing as the Ming Dynasty or something. It's just a fantastic experience.
It's the immersiveness. And that's why people like are totally sold on the Sim series, right? It's because it's this idea of controlling every single aspect of what's going on.
I would be lying if I didn't admit that with many of these games, there's also a deep appeal to the kind of like tidiness of control that they suggest. You know, like the Crusader Kings and Europa Universalis are a little bit better at this. They keep it pretty messy, but there is this kind of sense of like, you know, there is a pretty limited number of choices, and I can keep this control pretty tight if I play the game right.
Yeah, I think, and that's where my appeal to gaming is. So I'm from the school where platformers rule, right, the day. Like, I've Mario, Sonic, Metroid, like, that was my world.
Collect everything.
And I think the thing about platformers is that there's a right way to do it, right? Like, there's a way of doing the level so that you destroy all of the enemies, get all of the power-ups, do it in the most expedient amount of time. There's a right way to accomplish each level. And, you know, maybe you would, back in the day, go to Nintendo Power and figure out what that right way was. Yeah. Or you would just kind of accidentally figure it out yourself. but I think that that was, yeah, you touched on
it. There's a sense of mastery, right, Greg? Like when you get that level, you know, world 7 of Mario 3, right, or whatever, like you feel like, yes, I accomplished something.
When you had your thumbs going in the right way, it was total ritual, and you could get your mind to the point where it became sort of second nature.
Right.
It became like, oh yeah, and that was Ninja Gaiden for me. Like that was my game. Like growing up was getting all those right, and you know they would talk about, oh man, the difficulty level on this. But if you knew how to do it, the difficulty was nothing, and it was almost like being in a meditative state, mm-hmm. like being able to get through the platform in just the right way.
Greg,
that was always the appeal to me, I think.
That is the exact appeal to me for the Dark Souls series, which is a really hard series that you actually learn to master. And when you know how to win, when you know how to beat an enemy, you know how to get through an area, you come back and you're like, I can't believe I ever thought this was hard. I'm so good at it now. It's this incredible sense of accomplishment when you finally get through there and you realize that you can, of course I can take down that boss, it's no big deal, you know, on your second character or whatever. And that's an amazing experience that is really more of a console kind of experience, I think. And it's interesting that that PC games tend to be designed a little bit differently sometimes, but that it's really rewarding, you know, when a game is really designed very well to sort of plug that, you know, to get that sense of satisfaction from mastery.
Certainly the thing about the platformer for me was that it was a very individual activity, you know. It was something that I did on my own in my room. And, you know, when you're talking about RPGs, you're talking about communities. And I think that that was something that, especially online RPGs, right? And that was something that, you know, I think really sort of flies in the face of a lot of stereotypes that people have about gamers being isolationists, mm-hmm. or being loners. There's actually a thriving communities in the gaming world. They're not isolationists. They're connecting with each other. But how are they connecting with each other? Is it the medium that connects them, or is there something else that connects these people? And it's just the game that kind of provides the place for it to happen.
Well, I think, like, you know, there are as many different types of communities as there are communities, of course. Finding a community that has a starting point, being a video game that you all play, at least you know you all have something in common, and you can build up from there.
Right.
I personally have not found it to be a success in my life. I haven't really found sort of lasting friendships through the people that I meet through gaming, but that's me, you know, and I think it can happen for other people. Gaming's really just not that big a part of my life. So I tend to run into people in real life, like when, you know, we were all at seminary together and then conversation would just sort of turn to video games. And suddenly we kind of, it's like we lit up. We found, you know, brothers. And
right. It's like you have a language.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And it's that experience of having a shared set of experiences. The feeling of like leveling up in a game, like that's a particular experience, and it provides, you know, shorthand. It's a language. I'm with you, Chris. It's been rare that I've like bonded with somebody solely over video games. But when I make that connection, there's this like immediate familiarity, like a shortcut to friendship.
Yeah.
If there's already this other, you know, other sources of connection.
So I had a friend of mine who said that the first time he heard U2, he knew that he was going to buy every U2 album for the rest of his life, as long as they released CDs. And I had a similar experience when I played Final Fantasy for the first time. I knew I was going to be buying Final Fantasies until the end of time, just because there was something about that game.
See, that was Assassin's Creed.
It felt connected to. Right?
For me, that was Bethesda RPGs. You know, it was the first person exploration. Like, it just something about that scratched an itch that nothing else had ever had.
Yeah, right. Because there's something about meeting another person that has that same love.
Yeah.
That you're like, oh, you're in on it too. Like you're one of us, right?
Yeah.
That's exciting to have that interaction.
Yeah. And I've also found that, especially when it comes to, you know, the RPG immersive end of gaming versus, say, the Counter-Strike, Fast Twit Switch end of gaming.
Call of Duty.
Yeah, which is fine. That's perfectly cool thing. It's just not my deal. Meeting people who are really into the immersive role-playing strategy kind of thing, there are creative muscles that get worked in playing those games and thinking in that way that I find very pleasing in a conversation partner in ways that may or may not have to do with games themselves, but that sort of flexible, imaginative way of looking at the world and way of approaching problems, I find congenial.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, I've heard rectors at various churches that I've worked at make the statement that our parishes are a family, and I've never really felt that, and I've always kind of found it problematic, actually. Mm-hmm. And I remember having a discussion with Liz on the podcast a while back where I said, you know, it feels more like a team. It feels more like, you know, you've kind of adopted a favorite sports team, or you've begun to identify with a certain community. That's what it feels closer to rather than a family. It feels like you've chosen something. You've chosen some passion, and now you've found yourself surrounded by other people that have that similar passion. Mm-hmm. And that's what it feels like to find a parish where you sort of feel at home. And I think that there's something about this that's sort of that correlates to the gaming community. Finding those other Final Fantasy people and the way that we kind of find other parishioners that sort of share our ideas or that we feel comfortable sharing our ideas with. Maybe we don't all have to think the same, but we do all feel comfortable sharing with each other. I think that there's something about the communities that we choose.
Yeah.
So here's a question for me, right? So 67% of households in the United States, 2010, 67% of households had video games being played in them.
Wow.
And yet it still feels, doesn't it feel to you guys at least, as though it's kind of a countercultural thing, sort of a nerdy thing that like 20-year-old guys with cans of Rockstar drink? No.
Well, that's certainly been the image, right? I mean, been the self-image of the gamer culture. I mean, speaking as someone who grew up, I was, you know, nerdy gamer kid in my school, and like any kind of marginal group, you build up a sense of pride around your identity as that marginal group. But that identity has kind of been overtaken by the statistics that you're quoting. The identity is there, but the content isn't valid anymore.
There's these narratives that exist of gamers, the 20-year-old rock star sipping. But there's been an entire generation of kids that have grown up with games being normal, right? A normal part of their world. And that can be anybody. You know, it's important for us to point out in this podcast that we're all men sort of talking about this. And there is something about that, you know, about genders and who's playing and sort of stuff like that. But gamers can be anybody, and they can come from any place. They don't necessarily have to be locked into these narratives, but it's easy for us to believe the narratives are true.
It seems really, it would seem very kind of disingenuous to talk about stereotypes in gaming and not at least mention the Gamergate stuff, because not only I think was that as much about you know, the reaction of this small minority people to people who are pointing out stereotypes in games, but it only went to like reinforce other stereotypes of gamers.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, I kind of want to save the Gamergate stuff anyway for another conversation about Reddit and troll culture.
Yeah.
Like troll message board culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because that's kind of a hive mentality that kind of keeps supporting the same issues and trolling the same subjects and stuff like that. And misogyny is one of those. And so I want to kind of like save that for another discussion on another episode.
Yeah.
It turns out as well that 25%, this is in 2010 again, 25% of people playing video games regularly were over the age of 50, which that was the biggest surprise to me.
Wow. I believe that's one video game. I believe that's Candy Crush.
That would be the Wii.
Or the Wii, yeah. Well, I mean, the advent of iPhone and mobile video games has totally broken this open to all age groups in a way that it just was never considered before.
I don't know which game did it first, but, you know, there have been now quite a few games that have tried to weave in some sort of morality metric, component within the makeup for your character that shows you somewhere on a continuum, right, between evil and good, and displays that in different ways, you know,
BioWare does that a lot, like Mass Effect, BioWare, for example.
Yeah. KOTOR but the problem is that these are usually just too simplistic. Like, do you kill the right people or not kill the wrong people? And then you move along this slider, and you might get some little glowing devil horns or some ghostly white wings. I mean, it's now, I think, a system that has run its course, and it the developers need to come up with something deeper or just get rid of it, because it doesn't make any difference. You know, the only consequence I've ever seen is that, you know, a couple of times you get a slightly different cinematic playing out at the end of your game, depending on whether or not you're a good guy or a bad guy. And it's time for something deeper.
Telltale Games has The Walking Dead games, The Wolf Among Us. I think they have a Game of Thrones game coming out. But that's all it is. It's just about making choices. Right, you just go from one choice to the next, and each choice you make affects sort of the outcome of the game and stuff like that. And I remember there was one part of the first Walking Dead game, spoilers for people that ever played the Walking Dead game, there was one part where you had the option of taking food from a car that it looked like other people were using. And depending on if you took that food or not, affected like what was going to happen to you 3 episodes down the road, but you had no idea at the time, and you start to make justifications to yourself, like, oh, I'm a character, I need to survive. Oh, I'm trying to take care of other characters, they need to survive too. So it's right for me to take this food that may belong to someone else.
The first Walking Dead game is a great example of that, because you're right, Greg, but, you know, on one hand, I think you could look at a game like that and say the moral choices don't really matter that much. I mean, there's a kind of inevitability to the outcome regardless of the choices you make, which I think some people thought there was kind of a false sense of choice and consequence in the game. I think it was more of a stylistic choice, actually. The sense is that, you know, it's gonna end badly either way, right? It's a zombie game in a post-apocalyptic setting. I mean, there's no positive outcome. It's just a choice of which of the lesser evils you want, and that was a theme that ran through it. But then, of course, in that game, again, spoiler alert here, folks, at the very end, you are presented and challenged by someone who shows you all the choices you've made and challenges your assumptions and the choices that you've made up to that point in the game. So in a way, you know, the choices came back to haunt you, in the sense that there was a character, a kind of final boss, if you will, who's going to put those choices back in front of you and say, remember when you did that horrible thing? You're really a pretty terrible person, aren't you? And that was fascinating. I thought that was so well done and made the ethics of that game so much more rich, in the sense that the choices came back and had consequences in the narrative. It was very, very well done.
Now, so here's an interesting thing for you to dig into the next time you're looking for something fun to read. There's an article, a study called, I've got it here, Being Bad in a Video Game Can Make Us More Morally Sensitive. It was in the journal Cyber Psychology from June 2014. I don't know the actual date. June 20th. I do know the actual date. Cyber Psychology. And it's Matthew Grizzard, who's at the University of Buffalo, and some other staff at Michigan State and University of Texas. So what they figured out in this study is that gamers who intentionally make morally, quote, bad choices, wind up having a stronger guilt reaction later on, and it increases their sensitivity to moral issues. So their sense of, well, they say guilt. I would say that it intensifies the conscience. They become more aware of the cause and effect relationship. So that just makes things even more complex.
Well, it sort of takes the passion reading of "Crucify Him, Crucify Him" to a whole new level.
Interesting.
It's a very convicting
Walking Dead is a great example too. I mean, I come back to that because it's such a good example of it. It's a game that forces you to make bad choices. I mean, you're forced. You are literally several times forced to make choices between does person A die or person B die. You know, and you can't do both. And so you have to make a choice. And sometimes there's just no other option. And I think it's a fascinating way to create a conversation around ethics, though. And that's something that Walking Dead did a great job of.
And the other piece of those Telltale games that I really liked was that they would often put you in situations where you had to make a choice quickly.
Yes.
Because you had a timer that would sort of count down, that had the amount of time for you to make a choice. And for easy choices, or for choices that didn't necessarily matter, the timer would tick down slowly. But in sort of heightened, you know, sort of action sequences or something like that, the timer would go very quickly. And so you didn't get the opportunity to weigh options. You had to just go with your gut instinct of what you were going to do. And sometimes your gut instinct takes you into some pretty dark territory, it turns out.
So, and that's an interesting thing about these morality systems that are, you know, morality binaries, usually presenting pretty clear choices between good and evil, you know, in most cases, and certainly giving you clear feedback. You know, you shoot that civilian walking down the street and it tells you you've got 3 negative points, and then you know what kind of behavior they're going to reward and what they're going to punish. Most people, there's a study that I'm skimming through now because I looked at it a week ago, something like only 10% of people who play video games the first time through, if they play it through multiple times, you know, but only about 10% of people intentionally try to play as evil as they can. And this actually, there's a quote in here from Peter Molyneux, who's the creator of Fable. My prediction, this is the quote, "My prediction is all you guys, you're just going to be nice, sickeningly, sycophantically nice to each other. And it makes me sick because, you know, in a game like Fable, we spent months and years crafting the evil side of Fable, and only 10% of people actually did the evil side. Come on, you're supposed to be gamers."
In Civilization, you can fake your own custom religion, so that's interesting. Sid Meier's a Lutheran, by the way.
Is he really?
Yeah. Huh. And Sid Meier, that's also why, like, there's always Bible quotes, there's always quotes from Scripture in Civilization games.
Doesn't he want to make a dinosaur game? Am I making that
Doesn't he always want to make a dinosaur game?
I don't know. We do have a dearth of dinosaur games, though.
We've got Goat Simulator now. That's a step in the right direction. It's a short hop, skip, and a jump from Goat Simulator to Brontosaurus Simulator.
Well, that's a fantasy game, though. Brontosaurus never existed.
That's like the planet Pluto.
Yeah, Brontosauruses all live on the planet Pluto.
Pieces segment where we plug our ministries, our blogs, our Twitter feeds, whatever it is that lets people get in touch with us and lets us get in touch with people. So, Chris, where are you? What are you doing? And how can people find you?
That's a very good question. Well, you can always find me. I'm blogging not quite as much as I usually do, but it'll ramp back up. It's at fatherchristopher.org. That's father all spelled out. And my Twitter feed, at @FR_Christopher, Father Christopher. That's me. I'll see you online, friends.
Andy, where are you? What are you doing? How can people get in touch with you?
Andy Shamel, campus minister down at Stanford University with the Episcopal Lutheran Campus Ministry.
Nice. Can we find you online?
And you can find us online at elcm.stanford.edu. As far as what I'm doing, I'm actually working right now with some friends from college on a supplement for, I don't know if I'm legally allowed to say this, but I'll say it, for the Pathfinder role-playing game. We're starting a project of creating a campaign setting and series of adventures that are specifically designed to combat misogyny in the gaming world. So we're seeking to have a sort of anti-misogyny thing going on, and a big chunk of the proceeds is going to go to organizations that are fighting sex trafficking and violence against women. So nice. Check us out at bendbarsliftgates.org, all one word, no underscores, bendbarsliftgates.org. And you can reach me at andy@bendbarsliftgates.org. Or on the Facebook.
Dom, where are you? What are you doing? How can people find you?
Well, for the last less than a year, I've been rector of a church in Chandler, Arizona, and that's keeping me pretty busy. So for millennial, I don't really use social media that much, actually. So what can I say? I occasionally, very occasionally, tweet, which is @CircuitLoss on Twitter, if I'm going somewhere or doing something or have photos to share. And I have the same handle on Steam, which is, hey, if you want to play some games sometime, and if you want to play someone who's not a 15-year-old at Counter-Strike, you can play me.
Excellent. My name is Greg Knight. I'm the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida. You can find us on the web at bbts.org. I'm in Calhers. Available on all of your social media usual suspects lists. We are on Facebook, where you can like us and friend us. We're open to all kinds of Facebook interactions. You can just search Popping Collars and you'll find us. We're on Twitter at Popping Collars. We're on Instagram now, Popping Collars Podcast, where you can find us. You can also email us, poppingcollarspodcast@gmail.com. Our show is available on the usual places. You can subscribe to us at iTunes. You can follow us on Stitcher. You can follow us on TuneIn Radio. You can also follow us on SoundCloud. You can also find us on the Episcopal Cafe, which is a lovely website. And we appreciate them featuring our podcast each week. And so please check them out if you get a chance. And you can always go to our website, poppingcollarspodcast.com. For all of us at Popping Collars, that's our show for today. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Dominic, for coming in. Keep those collars popped. We'll see you next time.
Cheers. Wait.